This is Eddie, the Atari 8-bit podcast.
On this first episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast, we talk about the first Atari to be installed on a Navy submarine, two recent books about the Atari computers, are there really millions of ET carts buried in a landfill in New Mexico, and which Atari computer is the prettiest? All that and more. Let's go. All right, hello everyone. My name is Randy Kindig, and we want to welcome you to the first episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to talk about the vintage Atari 8-bit line of computers. We're going to cover news, talk about Atari computer history, present interviews, discuss the various Atari 8-bit computers and their capabilities, and even delve into technical topics such as display list interrupts or some of the special chips in the Atari 8-bit line. Mainly, we want this to be fun for everyone. Even if your favorite computer is the Apple II or the Commodore 64 or some other vintage computer, we want you to be able to learn something about Atari computers and why they hold a special place in our hearts. I'm just one of your hosts for this podcast. First of all, I want to welcome Kevin Savitz. Kevin, hello, and hello. Please tell the audience a little bit about yourself, where you're located, how you originally became involved with Atari 8-bit computers, and a little bit about your Atari collection.
Yeah, hi. I'm Kevin Savitz. I live in picturesque Portland, Oregon, and I am an Atari 8-bit computer nut. Let's see. My dad bought an Atari 800 when I was in sixth grade, and I that was my first love. I mean, it was literally the first thing that I just like adored, and I guess I never fell out of love with it. Dad and I did everything with that machine. Typed in games for magazines, and called BBSs, played a lot of Jumpman and Mule, and that just started my love affair with Atari computers. As for what I have one of every one of the Atari computers, 8-bit machines, at least one right on my desk right now next to my Mac. There's currently a 1200 XL, which I got at a thrift store a few weeks ago for $10. Along with a Gyrus cartridge, so that was exciting. And I have a few very rare 8-bit items and a huge cartridge collection, so 8-bit all the way. People may know me as the guy who runs a couple of Atari-oriented websites. I run AtariMagazines.com, which I started like 15 years ago or something, that has the full text of Antic and Start and a lot of articles from Compute and Creative Computing. And I also run AtariArchives.org, which has the full text of many Atari-oriented books. And last year, I wrote a book called Terrible Nerd, which is about, it's a memoir about my love of technology, and it has a drawing of me on the cover holding an Atari 800.
Kevin, I have your book. I love it. I just I'm still in the middle of reading it, but I can't wait to finish it. So next, we have a gentleman from the Atlanta area, Brad Arnold. Brad, tell us a little bit about yourself, your history with Atari 8-bits, and about your Atari collection.
Well, I got my first Atari 800 in 1981 when I graduated from a particularly difficult Navy computer school, and it was kind of a present to myself for finishing. And it was a 16K Atari 800. I upgraded up finally a little at a time up to 48K and bought the $500 floppy drive. My current Atari collection is a little bit of here, there, and yonder. Actually, sitting here next to me, I've got my an Atari 800 and an ATR 8000, which I've picked up recently and playing with. But I've got a probably got one of every one of the computers, but I'm not sure if they all work yet. And although my cartridge collection is not too good at the moment, I do have a lot of disc-based games. And especially I have a fondness for the old SSI war games, so I have a lot of those.
Before we go on, Brad, when we were talking at the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast, did you tell me that when you were in the Navy, you had an Atari with you on a submarine?
Yes. Yeah, I took my Atari 800 to sea one time on my ship, and I, at least for that particular ship, I was the first one to ever take a personal computer to sea with them. I had to get special permission from everybody and his brother to be able to take it, because that had never occurred to anyone before. So I took my Atari 800, my floppy drive, my monitor, and had to really strap them in good so they wouldn't go flying across the the compartment when we took rolls, because on a submarine sometimes you could roll pretty good. And I actually had some fun with it, and wrote some programs, and actually impressed some of the people who thought, wow, these things can actually do real work.
Awesome.
That's amazing. Did you make any converts while you were on there?
I think so. Actually, I wrote a simple little program to help them steer the ship and to do a particular maneuver. And it was actually fairly straightforward, but they were very impressed, because no one actually had ever thought about a computer being able to do something like that. I think they started looking at the computers in a different way than, it's like, hey, these are useful tools. Did any of them buy Ataris or anything? Unfortunately, no. The only guy who I know of who bought a computer actually bought a Coleco Atom on clearance.
Oh, no.
It's like, oh, boy. And but, hey, at least he got something. But actually, I'm not sure that's something I would admit to. But
that's an interesting story, Brad. That's pretty cool. I'm going to move forward here. My name is Randy Kindig, as I mentioned before. I host another vintage computing podcast called Floppy Days, which is a more general vintage computing podcast and covers all vintage computers. I hail from the Indianapolis area and have been involved with vintage computers for about 5 years. My first computer really was a TRS-80 Model 1 with 4K of RAM and 4K of ROM. I remember that distinctly in 1979. But my first real computer, not to say the Model 1 wasn't a real computer, was an Atari 800, which I got around 1981. I loved the color and sounds, neither of which the TRS-80 supported. I remember buying my first floppy drive for that computer and thinking how great that was. And I eventually upgraded to an Atari 800 XL, which I had until I later moved to the Atari 16-bit line. I even submitted an article or two to Antic and Analog magazine, which never got published. My collection isn't as large, it sounds like, as Kevin's and Brad's, but I do have a 400, an 800, 800 XL, 65XE, a drive, a couple of cassettes, a printer, and a pretty large collection of Atari books, magazines, and software cartridges and discs. So that's me, that's us. Welcome to the first show.
I hope I can talk my parents into buying me an Atari 800 XL.
Huh, tell them all the things it can do for you.
Right, I'll tell them it's got 256 colors and 4 sound channels.
I don't know, that's a little technical. Why don't you tell them it'll help you learn music and art?
Well, and there's integrated software for word processing, spreadsheets, forecasting.
No, tell them it'll help you write term papers.
I'll tell them it's expandable with serial link peripherals like modems and disk drives.
Tell them it's your birthday.
Next, we thought we'd do a news section where we talk about current news and happenings in the Atari world. And Kevin, I believe you had the first thing.
Yeah, well, it's not too often that Atari-related things make it into the mainstream news, but I first heard about this one through NPR, and it was in a lot of mainstream publications. Besides, it's that this company wants to make a documentary where they go to the Alamogordo dump where allegedly Atari buried millions of ET cartridges, you know, back in 1983, and they want to dig it up and see what they find. I guess this myth is known well enough that a bunch of magazines and newspaper articles covered it. So the myth is that after the ET game for the 2600 came out and was a massive failure, Atari took tons and tons of these cartridges and put them in the dump and covered in dirt and so they could take a tax loss on them. And so this company called Fuel Industries, which is a digital agency and entertainment studio with offices in Los Angeles and Ottawa, Canada, is apparently doing some sort of documentary, and they want to go out there and see what they find. But there's some controversy about this, about what actually is there, and I guess that's what they're going to go find and see. But Kurt Vendel, who wrote a book about the history of Atari that I think we're going to talk about soon, he said that there were never thousands of ET games built buried in Alamogordo. It's a myth that sprung up later and one that was never once mentioned by the actual press articles of the time. The dump there, he says, is simply a clearing out of Atari's Texas manufacturing plant as it transitioned to automated production methods and as a focus on personal computer manufacturing. It had previously been one of the main plants for manufacturing game cartridges and other hardware, and game manufacturing was being moved overseas to China. As part of the transition, unused cartridge stock and a group of titles, not just ET, console parts, computer parts, were all dumped there and in New Mexico at that Alamogordo dump. It was covered in detail by the Alamogordo Press at the time and is just such a non-mystery that I'm surprised by all this. So it sounds like maybe there's ET cartridges there. Maybe there's other stuff, other Atari history that's rotting under the earth that may be even better. And if this company follows through, then we'll find out. What do you guys think? Randy, what's your guess of what they're going to find?
Well, it should be pretty interesting. I don't know. Maybe they'll find all those. I heard the same thing about Apple had dumped a bunch of computers back in the day. Maybe they'll find those instead. I don't know.
That's what I was going to say, is they're going to find all those old leases.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. So it'll be interesting to find out whether they actually go through with this or not.
Yes, it will. It seems like this company is, I'm not sure what their motivation is for doing other than doing a TV show or a documentary, but hopefully they'll find something good and then know what to do with it if they find it, assuming it's not completely ruined. Okay, what's up next?
Recently, I was reading on the Atari Age forums that they've discovered there's a group in Poland, I believe, that is working on an Atari XL XE accelerator board called the Rapidus, I believe. And this board replaces the normal 6502 CPU, which is then plugged into the accelerator board itself. The accelerator is going to be a 65C816 chip running at 16 megahertz, which is what, about a little over eight times faster than the 6502 does.
Standard 6502 is
1.79. It's going to have up to a meg of SRAM and then 30 megabytes of storage RAM, which I'm not quite sure if that is like they're using like a CF card or something for storage. Seems to be fairly early in the development cycle, but they've got a couple prototypes that they've shown, and there's some videos. The link will be in the show notes to the Atari Age forum post, which has videos on YouTube showing the thing in action, and it's it appears to be quite fast.
I want it.
Yeah, me too. That is really cool. So all of that is on the board, the RAM and ability to have additional storage, and everything is on that one board?
Everything is on that one board. It's going to have space for the OS in Flash. Apparently, there's going to be still some Flash available to where you could load cartridges, cartridge images into Flash. And and then there's apparently some other functionality that they're not ready to announce yet, that I guess is still a little early in their development cycle. But it's shaping up to be very impressive. Even if it's half as good as what, you know, they're trying for, it's still going to be an excellent product.
Yeah. Was there any talk about what it might possibly cost? I'm sure it won't be cheap.
You know, I don't think there has been yet. I think it's just a little early, and I don't remember anyone talking cost yet. I think everybody's just really wanting it to come out.
Sure. Yeah, and I think we're all some of those people.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Brad. That was very interesting. The next topic is mine. I wanted to talk about an Atari book that had recently come out. I know it's not something that's come out in the last 30 days, but since this is our first show, it's recent enough. It's a new book called Atari Inc. Business is Fun by Mr. Kurt Vindel. Is it Vindel? Vindel? It's the first of three volumes, and this one covers Atari from its beginnings up to the Tramiel buyout in 1984. Coverage of all three main divisions of Atari, the computer, console, and coin. It sounds like, and I've got this book on order, so I don't actually have it in my hand yet, but I read a lot of the reviews on Amazon, and it sounds like there are lots and lots of fascinating stories. It has 800 pages and lots of photos.
Yeah, 800.
And yeah, it sounds like it's a Bible, and this is just first of three volumes. But it sounds like it's a pretty comprehensive history of the Atari 8-bit computer line, and it was rated 4.5 stars on Amazon. So do either one of you own that book?
I funded the Kickstarter for it. I was supposed to receive an early early version of it and then didn't. And I just got a hold of Kurt, and he apologized and just this week and says that my signed copy is on the way. So I have not actually read it, even though I helped kickstart it, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay.
I've read it. I got it for, not for Christmas. I got it after Christmas, but I've read it. It is a tome. It is big. It's pretty good. Like you said, there's lots of stories. I can definitely recommend it to Atari people. Lots of interesting stories, and it seems like they must be holding back some stories, because I've heard stories. There's a bunch of stories I've heard in the past that it's like, well, where's this story? Where's that story? And I guess they're holding some stuff for the other two books.
Yeah,
sure.
But it does flesh out a lot of gray areas. So I enjoyed it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Kevin, I think you had something you want to talk about next.
Yeah, so I love archive.org's computer magazine collection. And so every episode I want to just like kind of pick something that's retro computer related or hopefully Atari related and just kind of highlight something that's new and interesting there. Now, if you don't know it, archive.org, their computer magazine collection, they have a team of people that digitize all sorts of books and magazines in every genre, but Jason Scott is there, and he's got a particular proclivity for scanning computer magazines. So there are there's an amazing amazing collection of computer magazines covering Apple, Atari, Amstrad, you know, any computer you can think of, going back to the 70s and before. And a link to that is in the show notes. So the one that I just want to kind of pick today, they've recently added a whole flock of Electronic Games Magazine. Now, Electronic Games Magazine is one that kind of has a kind of a special place in my heart. you know, my friend, when I was a kid, my friend Michael used to subscribe, and I used to like read, you know, we read every issue cover to cover when they came. And it was a magazine that specialized in arcade games, coin-op games mostly, but they also got into computer software games later and that sort of thing. So there are all sorts of in-depth articles about how, you know, strategy, how to win at this game or that game, interviews with people, and announcements about new games that are just about to come out, and you know, some of them, of course, didn't really come out, and a lot of them did. And you go like, oh, you know, look at these early screenshots or even drawings of games before they came out. Really fascinating stuff. And there's a couple of dozen issues to read. And if you ever read this magazine back in the day, or didn't, there's fascinating early history about arcade games and computer software. So Electronic Games Magazine at archive.org.
Thank you, Kevin. I love that site as well. I don't know if you guys ever watched the Computer Chronicles, but they have all those old shows archived there, and I love to go watch some of those old shows. There actually were some shows that were Atari-related at the time. So
we should maybe in the future episode highlight one of those and talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, the next time I want to talk about, I know it's going to seem like that we're maybe stressing books and magazines a lot in this first episode. But
we're geeks, and geeks like to read.
I love books. I've got a huge collection of books, and I'm really a vintage computer book collector. So the other day I was in a bookstore, and I was back in the magazine section, and I came across a giant magazine that was entitled the Atari 40th Anniversary Special. And I picked that up and took a look at that, and it's really a great book. Atari was founded in 1972. I don't know how many people know that they're that old, but so this actually probably came out in 2012, but I didn't see it until a couple months ago. And so they're celebrating the 40th anniversary. It's just a one-issue magazine that covers a lot of the products they produced and has a lot of Atari history in there. There's a lot of full-color pictures and a lot of really good articles. And there's an entire section on the 8-bit computer line, mm-hmm. including an article on the 800XL and an article on the top 10 games made for the 800XL, as well as they also discussed the next 56. Now, since this magazine was put out by the makers of Retro Game Magazine, it has a decided focus on games rather than productivity software. But still, I would recommend it to anyone who's an Atari fan.
It's a little bit hard to get because I think Retro Game Magazine is a UK magazine,
and so this was
published in the UK, and you know it's kind of inflated price because someone has to import it. I just got this from my birthday a couple weeks ago, and
oh, did you?
And
okay.
I love it. It's fascinating to page through. There's all these great pictures about Atari stuff. And yeah, you mentioned that the article about the top 10 games of the 800XL. Now, of course, you know, I have my opinion of the top games, and everyone does. But I was looking through this list, going, I barely knew what 6 of these 10 games are. So now I feel like there's like these awesome games out there that I don't even know about. So I need to go.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't done it yet. I'm just like I can hardly wait to like discover what I missed. You know, these great games that are out there.
Yeah, I felt the same way because I never was a big gamer, and some of the games I was familiar with, but most of them I wasn't. So you're right, it's a good way to go and discover some of those things. It's not cheap at $20, but you know that's really not bad considering the size of the book and you know the quality of it. So I would certainly recommend it. Okay, the next topic we wanted to. Each show have a particular feature that we covered, and for this show, we wanted to talk about the individual Atari machines, and I'm going to turn it over to Brad to talk about those.
This is not meant to be an exhaustive history of Atari or the corporation or their machinery, but rather a quick 600-mile-per-hour, 10,000-foot overview. And we'll be going into more depth on all this in future episodes. As Randy mentioned a moment ago, Atari was founded in June of 1972 to make coin-op games. Pong was Atari's first game, not Computer Space, which some people think. Computer Space was designed while Nolan was at a company called Nutting and Associates. In 1976, though, Atari needed cash to bring out the what would eventually be called the 2600. In order to get that cash, Atari was sold to Warner Communications for about $30 million. And nowadays, $30 million is like, you know, that's pocket change for most of these companies. In 1976 dollars, that was significant. And soon after it shipped, two of the designers of the Atari Video Computer System, or the 2600, started working on its successor, and they called it the Colleen Project. Since it takes years to design, test, and get a new machine ready, by the time the old one is ready to be retired, the new one will be then there to replace it. Originally, this Colleen machine was basically just going to be an improved VCS. It's going to have keyboard, more memory, better graphics. But Warner had been watching Apple and Tandy with the their computers. They decided they wanted to get into the home computer market in addition to the home video game market. Rather than messing up their cash cow, the VCS, they opted to turn Colleen into a true home computer. And while there were many people on the design team, two guys, Jay Miner and Joe DeCure, generally get the most credit for designing what would be known as the Atari 400 and 800 computers. The Atari 400 and the Atari 800 were announced in late 1978 and were widely available for purchase in 1979. Originally, the 400 was called the Candy, and the 800 was called the Colleen. While they were being developed, Atari had a habit of naming their projects, development projects, after secretaries in the company. When the 400 shipped, it was $550 and originally had 4K of RAM. The 800 shipped at $1,000 roughly with 8K of RAM. And both were expandable up to 48K normally, but with aftermarket parts and things, you could go pretty much high as you wanted to go. Both computers had the 6502 MOS CPU running at 1.79 megahertz. MOS, by the way, was owned by Commodore. Apple and Atari both bought their CPUs from one of their biggest rivals, Jack Tramiel. Both machines had Atari BASIC on cartridge. The 800 had two cartridge slots. The 400 only had one cartridge slot. And since the 400 only had one cartridge slot, the second slot in the 800 generally went unused. There was like only like four or five cartridges really ever produced for the right slot in an Atari 800. What made their hardware interesting on these two computers was the custom chips they had. They had the CTIA, which is the Color Television Interface Adapter. And that's ran the video. And this was just an improvement over the VCS's TIA, Television Interface Adapter. The CTIA was the original video chip in the 400 and 800, although it really wasn't supposed to be. Originally, it was supposed to have shipped with what was called the GTIA, with the Graphics Television Interface Adapter. But the GTIA had too many bugs to ship with, so they shipped with a lower capability one until they got the bugs stomped out, and then they upgraded the future ones to the GTIA chip. If you, like mine, my original Atari 800 came with the older CTIA chip, you could get an upgrade, which is basically it was just a chip. And for $40, you could buy the chip and then another, I think it was like $75 to have the technician put it in. It's like, well, being a computer tech myself, I saved that $75. But the GTIA added several more video modes and a little bit better graphics. Next was the Antic, the alphanumeric television interface controller.
Which is actually where we got the name for this podcast.
Yeah, I like that one. And the Antic is actually does a lot of graphics and control for the kind of like a traffic cop between the GTIA and the other chips. Then there's the Pokey, which is the potentiometer keyboard integrated circuit. And that one reads your keyboard and other inputs and outputs. It's the sound chip. And then finally, there's the SIO, which on the Atari line, the SIO is the major part of the interface. In this case, it's a serial input-output. So it does most of the interfacing to the world. Most devices were serial. Very, very few non-serial devices on the 800-400 line. These special chips, there's a debate on whether to call them true coprocessors or not, or just support chips. I like calling them coprocessors just because it makes it easier in discussion. May not be technically correct, but hey. I personally think those chips help the 8-bit family stand out amongst the other computers of the time. Most 8-bit computers at that time, the CPU did a lot, if not most, of the heavy lifting of reading the keyboard, doing the display, doing the sound. It did everything. And by having these coprocessors take the load off of it, it allowed the CPU to spend more time doing work. As time went on, other companies saw that was the way to go. You know, the Commodore 64 had their SID chip, sound chip, which was just, you know, that's a great sound chip. After they shipped the 400 and 800, Jay Miner, the developer of those, he met with Warner Management to discuss starting development of the successor to the 400 and 800. That didn't work out so well, and we'll come back to that in a moment. By 1982, Atari was ready to release the 1200 XL. People generally think that this was the computer itself was a good idea, but a bad implementation. You know, it doesn't look like a bad computer. I've got one. It's okay, but they've made some changes that it's not as backwardly compatible as it could have been. It should have or should have been. It had no real expansion. There's just one cartridge slot. They took out two joystick ports, which on the 800 was a very popular thing because you could play there were several four-player games, Mule being one of the most popular ones. And its video, the 1200's video, had some definite issues. And it was not much cheaper. And actually, when it was announced and people actually saw them, the 800 still hadn't disappeared from the shelves yet, so the sales of the 800 actually spiked up until they were cleared out because people wanted the 800 rather than the 1200 XL. Atari realized that it wasn't such a good thing after all because it only lasted about a year. They hadn't even started to recoup their development costs on that yet, so they realized they had an issue there.
Yeah, Brad, I noticed on eBay, if you go to buy a 1200 XL, they tend to go for more money because they're more rare, and people like to collect them, I guess. I don't currently own one in my collection.
Yeah, I've got two because I actually bought collections off of a couple people years ago. when actually on eBay, people would actually sell their entire collection. And that's how I ended up with two. But some people do like the keyboards, though. I haven't used one enough to say, but I do know some people modify the heck out of theirs to give it the missing functionality because they like the form factor and the keyboard. And it is a nice looking machine. I think it's I'm kind of partial to the 800, but as far as the XLs go, I like its looks. It's nice and sleek, and
it's quite a bit bigger than the 800 XL or the other XL machines.
Yeah, it does take up some desk space. And following on after the 1200, a year later in 1983, they released the 600 XL and the 800 XL. And I forgot to mention the 1200 XL had 64K of RAM, and it came in one configuration, 64K, and that's what you got. The 600 XL shipped with 16K, and the 800 XL shipped with 64K of RAM. And they did add what's called the Parallel Bus Interface, or PBI, to allow devices to interface to the machine again, which was a good idea. Then, after they, roughly about a year later, maybe not quite a year, it was probably just a few months after that, they were supposed to have shipped the 1400, the 1400 XL and the 1400 XLD, which, when I saw the first advertisements for those things, I would have bought one. I would have gone out and sold my car and got loans to get the 1400, the 1450 XLD.
Absolutely.
I wanted that machine.
And they had actually produced some catalogs that had pictures of these machines, and everyone was just like, oh yeah, must have.
I remember hearing about those at the time, but I don't remember what was different about those. Did they have built-in drives or something?
Well, they were effectively the same machine. The only real difference between the two of them was the 1450 XLD had one or two built-in 5 1/4 floppy drives. And generally it's assumed they were going to be effectively 1050s, but there are some, I've read once or twice that some people thought that they were trying to get a true double-sided floppy drive in there. I think it was supposed to be just a pair of 1050s.
And they would have added some other features, versus the 800 XL. There was a built-in modem. There was speech synthesis. All sorts of magic.
Yeah. But the 1400 was and the 1450. The only difference between those was the floppy drives. But the difference between those two and the 800 XL, yeah, like you said, there was a whole lot of magic going to be in there. Actually, those were. Apparently, 12 prototypes were built. 12 is the number, last number that I remember seeing, roughly. They were never, ever, sold. They were, those were just prototypes that, people got a hold of. But recently, some bare motherboards surfaced, and people were able to get together the schematics and the bill of materials, and I think a lot of it came from Kurt and his projects to archive all this stuff. But they're able to get all the documentation and design together, and people have actually built from scratch, starting with the bare flat green empty motherboard, build a full 1400. And apparently someone has built a 1450 XLD. So there's actually now 14 of them in existence that we know of. And they think maybe there might be one or two more out there that guys have built. But yeah, those were the holy grail of the 8-bit models. Everyone wanted one of those.
I bet if you had one, it'd be worth a good chunk of money.
Oh, yeah.
Not as much as an Apple One, but a lot of money, I'm sure.
Yeah. like I said, those never did see the light of day. And one of the reasons why, in 1984, Jack Tramiel buys Atari. We'll go into more into that in future episodes. I'll just leave that there. Following the 600 and 800 XLs, you had the 65 XE and 130 XE computers. The 65 XE had 64K of RAM. Why they called it a 65 when it had 64? Oh, whatever. Marketing people. And the 130 XE had 128K of RAM. Then on these, they changed the parallel bus interface to an enhanced cartridge interface. And also, at this time, they came out with the what some people call the ZEGS, or XEGS, which was a game system that was just a modified 65XE. And it was just the 65XE. They put it in a case that didn't have a keyboard on it and shipped it with a light gun, effectively.
So that was kind of the third. There were of the three generations, kind of all had their own look too. You had the 400, 800 kind of looked one way, and then the XL series kind of had a silver and brown motif, and then with the XEs, they kind of jumped into a kind of your classic beige plastic look.
Right, and their ST line had basically the same look as well as the XE. I don't know about you guys, but my favorite of all of them is the 800. I just love the look and the design of that particular machine.
I gotta say, I love the 800, and it was like I said at the top, it was my first love. But visually, just going on looks, I gotta say it's the 400. The keyboard was unusable.
Really?
It didn't have enough RAM, but it is just like the quintessential 1970s idea of what the future would look like. It's a beautiful machine.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I totally agree with you. I like the look. I like the machine. I don't like the look as much as I like the 800, but I do like the look. A friend of mine years ago, he actually bought a 400 and bought one of the replacement keyboards for it. And we got him upgraded to 48K of RAM. Mm-hmm. So effectively, it almost looks like it's half the size of an 800. But if you're not using the monitor out, which he wasn't, he was just using a 13-inch TV set, mm-hmm. he effectively had an Atari 800 in a much smaller size and for, you know, half the price. The true successor to the 800 or the 8-bit family was not the Atari ST. In an odd bit of irony, I don't know, karma, whatever, the Atari ST was designed by Commodore, and the Amiga 1000 was designed by Atari. And when you look at an Amiga 1000 and look at its design, you'll see that it was designed by the same guys who designed the Atari 800. The same philosophy is in there, with the support chips and the way everything works together. Like the speed of the 6502 at 1.79 megahertz, that's an increment of the video sync of the television sets. You know, the clock speed was set to match the TV set, not just as fast as we can get it. Because you can clock a 6502 faster than that.
That's one thing I always liked about the Atari 8-bit line. It seemed like they were designed to work well with a TV set. I mean, that's what was so nice about them.
Yes. Yeah, for years, actually, on my Ataris, I always used television sets. I never had a monitor. I finally got a monitor just recently. And 'cause television sets work great.
Yeah. Atari never actually came out with an Atari-branded monitor for the 8-bits. Everyone
That's
who
right.
wanted actually use a monitor that I knew, most everyone used TV sets, but those the rich kids that I knew that had a monitor, they all had Commodore monitors.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever had my 8-bit attached to a monitor the whole time I had an 8-bit until I got back into retro computing a few years ago, but yeah.
Yeah, I almost bought an amber screen back in the day. One of my friends had an amber screen on his whatever it was. I can't remember some other machine he had, but I liked it because it was so crisp and clear. But one thing is like, oh, you can't play games on that. Yuck. No, never mind. I was a big gamer. I love my games.
All right, I think we're done. Thank you for listening to the show. As this is our first show, we certainly welcome any and all feedback. What are we doing well? What are we not doing well? Do you have any suggestions for show topics? Please also take a minute and rate the show on iTunes. That's really the best way you can help a new podcast that you like. Give it a great rating on iTunes.
Subscribe and give it a rating.
Give it a rating.
Those are the two things you can do.
Yep. So please take 2 seconds and give Antic some